Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk. I am very excited this morning to talk to an author. His name is Jim Salisbury. He's covered the Phillies for a lot of years, and his new book is called The Rotation. It's all about the Phillies rotation of 2011, and he's here to talk about it. Hello.
Hi, David.
How are you?
I'm doing well, and I just want to point out it's co-authored with my longtime colleague and friend Todd Zielecki.
Right, Todd Zielecki, who is off somewhere else at the moment.
Yes.
Now, whose idea was the book, first of all? I mean, it's such a terrific book, and it's such a great price. Running Press, it's out from Running Press, and it's $15, so it's affordable for anybody, which is really nice.
Yeah, it was just a kind of author idea. We were longtime teammates at the Philadelphia Inquirer. We covered the Phillies together for many years, and recently went our own separate ways. Todd went to MLB.com, and I went to CSNPhilly.com, the website for Comcast Sportsnet. And, you know, we had actually, as the Phillies had gone on this run, you know, they won five division titles and a World Series and got into another World Series. A few years back, we talked about maybe one day taking a step back, trying to put the organization's rise into perspective, and maybe, you know, throw it between two covers and see if we could write a book about the organization's rise. And then in December of 2010, they signed Cliff Lee and put together this fabulous rotation with Lee and Halliday and Cole Hamels and Roy Oswalt. And immediately people started saying, is this one of the best rotations of all time? Is it a historic rotation? Where can this team go with this rotation? You know, this is going to be a juggernaut. And we were just, you know, much like fans, a little bit caught up in the rotation that they had put together and what it could do for this team. And we just kind of came to the conclusion that, wow, this might be a cool book to kind of write about this potentially greatest rotation of all time and let that rotation lead us through the season, kind of as the backdrop for chronicling what we thought maybe had the potential to be a very great season. And we came to the conclusion that, yeah, we want to do this. And we made some phone calls, and the next thing you knew, we got it off the ground.
Yeah, and it's a great book. It's just that when you went through the season last year, it was such a heartbreaking season for the Phillies fans, and which is a downer. But it's fascinating to watch. You go through every month of the year, and we get the behind the scenes a little bit about what was going on. And do you think there was too much pressure on the pitchers?
I really don't, David. And the reason I say that is, you know, they're all at the top of their field. And it takes a physical component to reach the top of your field in athletics. And it also takes a mental component, a mental toughness. And all those guys have it. So they weren't going to cave to the pressure of being potentially one of the greatest rotations of all time. And then, you know, the proof was kind of in the production. They were the best starting staff in the majors, ERA-wise, since the mid-80s. We spoke to some really notable historians of baseball who put them among the top two or three greatest ever. You know, their shutouts and the innings pitched and the ERA and their strikeouts. So they actually did measure up to some of the greatest rotations of all time. They didn't get that final prize they wanted, but statistically, They had three guys in the top five in Cy Young voting.
Right.
Now, that's happened to be four. It's happened actually eight other times. But this, you know, the pitching coach even said he thought they exceeded expectations. So I thought they lived up to the hype, and I thought they handled the pressure very well.
Right. I agree with you there. I just wonder though, when the other player and the players they're going to face hear about this, all this hype about these pitchers, that they don't try to extra hard to beat them somehow, find a way to get around that. And when it's publicized so much all over the news, I mean, probably all over the United States about in baseball as far as how great these pitchers are, that the players don't think, well, we got to find a way to beat them.
if that doesn't happen, something is wrong with the opposing athlete, because that's the nature of competition. You always want to, you know, David always wants to take down the Goliath. You know, the whole, you know, subject of hype and excitement and publicity is very real. These guys don't live under a rock. They know who the highly touted guys are. And, you know, a team like the Phillies who had success and now puts together a rotation like that absolutely has a target on their back. That's just the nature of sports. And, you know, you have to want to knock that target off. When you've had the success of the Phillies and have the personnel they do, teams get up. They put their Sunday best on to try to beat you every day. These aren't the days of the late 1990s where the Phillies were just kind of an also-ran that, you know, had tread marks on their back from being run over. These guys have a target on their back, and that's a lot different. It's certainly better than the alternative of the late 90s when baseball, as we get into in the book a little bit, the late 90s when baseball was irrelevant.
Now, how many games do you go to in the course of a season? Like this year there'll be 162 games, but how many games do you actually go to of the Phillies?
That's a good, it varies year to year. In various times in my career, it's varied because my role has been different, but, you know, I'm pretty much the beat guy now and responsible for the day-to-day stuff. I would bet I'm there 120 to 130 games.
Wow, you really are a fan.
Well, I like the game, but it's my job.
Yeah, it's your job, too.
You know, but... And Todd and I, we didn't want to BS anybody in this book. So we actually coordinated our days off last year. So, you know, I think we were there for all but, one of us was there for all but three games, I believe it is the way it shook out, because, you know, we had a travel day or something, or going to the West Coast, and, but, you know, we were there all the time, obviously for our day jobs, in which, you know, we compete like heck, but, you know, when the dust settled on a particular day or a particular week or a particular month, we'd get together and kind of come up with a plan about how we wanted to execute that chapter.
Right, and when you read the book, it's hard to put this thing down because it's just so fascinating to watch. And as you're reading the book, I went through the season with the Phillies. I watched most of the games. I wouldn't say all the games, but I remember these little different things that happened, and I think, oh yeah, I forgot about that. There's little things you forget happen during the course of the season, and that's why when you go back and read the rotation, you start to remember them all, and it brings back memories. Now, of course, there were some bad memories toward the end of the season. We all have to live with that, and I'm still smarting from it from last year. I guess a lot of fans are, but
as I tell people, it's not a Disney story. It's not a guaranteed happy ending.
Much as we want it to be.
Just because it doesn't have a happy ending doesn't mean it's not a good story. And I think,
right,
you know, it's a good story. And, you know, one of the things we tried to, you know, I've always been really aware of myself as a writer. I'm not like, you know, I'm not the greatest writer on earth. I think what my strength is keeping my eyes open and gathering a lot of details, that little detail that you can look back on a year later and say, oh, I remember when that happened. And I think we both kind of tried to attack it that way, have it be a really detail-driven book.
Now, were the players aware of the book? I mean, did you go to the different players? There's different quotes from the different pitchers and things. Did you go to them and talk to them?
Some of them were aware of it. And some of them weren't. You know, we were doing this stuff anyway for MLB.com and for CSNPhilly.com. You know, a lot of these quotes appeared in game stories or other stories that we wrote during the year. And by the time we got around to doing the book, you know, we reprised them. We did more reporting. We amplified certain situations and got into things a little more deeply because time would permit. But some people were aware, some people weren't, and we were just there as in our everyday role as reporters covering the team.
Now, I know it's your job, but you've got to be a huge fan to begin with to even undertake a job, and it sounds like this was quite an undertaking, going to all these different games and reporting all and with the Phillies as long as you have. I think since Mike Lieberthal, is that when you started, about the Mike Lieberthal time?
started covering the Phillies then. I'd covered other teams before then, before I came to Philadelphia.
What other teams did you cover?
Well, I started covering a Triple A team, the Pawtucket Red Sox, out of college, and came to that was in the late '80s, and then came to Philadelphia in '94, and actually spent a year after that in New York covering the Yankees at the New York Post before coming back and working at the Philadelphia Inquirer for 13 years. And but you're right, you know, as a kid, my passions were I loved newspapers, I loved the sports page, I loved sports, and I loved baseball, and I hated mathematics, and I was terrible in it, and I was pretty good in English. So it sort of all added up that maybe this might be what I should do with my life.
Well, it certainly benefits us to read a book like this. And I wonder, do we put too much pressure on baseball players? I mean, do we expect too much of them? I wonder, as a fan, whether I do sometimes. Whether you think, well, they're getting paid all this money. They really should know how to perform, and it should be easy for them. How do you feel about that?
Well,
excuse me.
Yeah, I actually have this conversation a lot with people. Baseball is an easy game to play, but it's a hard game to play well. It's a tough, tough game. You know, we've all done it in the backyard. We did it in high school. We did it in Little League. These are the best of the best of the best. Literally the best in the world. I don't know if we put too much pressure on them, but I think at times we lose sight that it's a really hard game. That guy on the mound is standing 10 inches in the air on a mound 60 and a half feet away. And he might be 6'5" and throwing 92 with late movement, and you're trying to hit that. It's a really hard game, and then when you do hit a pee at the shortstop's feet, you know, it comes in at 92 and goes out at 107, and the shortstop picks it cleanly. That's a hard thing to do. And, you know, one of my real pet peeves is when somebody says a guy stinks. I just don't think they stink at this level. I think maybe they didn't play well that day. Maybe the game was too tough for them that day. But they're still the very, very best players in the world. And they, the good ones, you know, you mentioned pressure. The good ones can handle it. As I said earlier, there's a physical and a mental component. And the good ones, the great ones, handle both very well. I won't say they handle it with ease, because I don't think there's anything easy about this game.
There's so much pressure from the press. I mean, all the players have to be careful what they say, you know, because it gets back. It goes all over the internet. I mean, if they say one thing that somebody doesn't like, you know, the whole Jimmy Rollins thing when he said about the players.
Yeah, well,
you know,
stuff spreads a lot faster, and I think players are more aware of that. They get more media training than ever now. As rookies or even minor leaguers, Major League Baseball runs programs like that. And you see more of an awareness of what is coming out of their mouth, more of a guardedness. You know, I guess that's just the way we're going with the world.
Well, how do you feel as far as whether the rotation was the best of all time? I mean, you watched it all last year. How do you feel it compares to the Atlanta Braves one, the Mets one?
Well, they didn't win the World Series, and that's why you play the game, to win the World Series. That's why the Phillies spent $177 million on that team, to win the World Series. They didn't do that. It was a fun and entertaining and, you know, successful season in many, many ways. They won 102 games, a franchise record. They sold out every game, so from a business aspect, very successful. But, you know, the reason these guys play, there's stages in a player's career. You want to make it, you want to make a lot of money, and then you want to win a championship. And most of these guys have reached that stage three where they're comfortable, they're established, they want to win a championship. And they didn't win a championship, so I don't think you can crown them as the very, very best of all time, especially when they were let down a little bit by their pitching, or quite a bit, I should say, by their pitching in October. Cliff Lee didn't protect a 4-0 lead in Game 2, and that really, really hurt them. You know, that Braves team did win a World Series. A lot of people thought they had a lot of unfulfilled expectations because they only won. They'd never had that big run of World Series, but they did win that one World Series They had Cy Young winners, three guys who slam dunks to go to the Hall of Fame. I think the Phillies rotation probably is shy of them, but boy, not too far off. And but you know, I don't think you can call them the greatest of all time because they just didn't win a World Series, and it's such a subjective thing. But they're definitely in the argument.
What are the pitchers like right before the season starts? I mean, what kind of excitement have you been there for the first game before it starts? How exciting is it for the pitchers? I mean, are the players as excited about the season as the fans are?
They are. I mean, they're not. It's not like high school football banging your head against the locker. You know, they're professionals. They do this every day for 6, 7, 8 months sometimes. But, you know, there is an excitement before opening day, no question. But for a pitcher, usually they're locked in this kind of cocoon of preparation where they're, you know, a lot of pitchers, they won't talk. They won't even look at you. They won't even look at their wives, some of them, on the day they pitch because they get out of bed and they...
Are they that superstitious? Is it superstition or is it...
Halliday's wife has made comments like that, or he's made joking comments that he doesn't even talk to his wife on the day he pitches. I'm sure it's an exaggeration, but he does wrap himself kind of in this steel cage, and he visualizes hitters, and he visualizes his game plan. Schilling was the same way. Hamels is very similar. Jamie Moyer was he would go through a whole mental routine. Where he'd have this, like, gosh, it was like probably like a 5x5 index card type of thing, and it had 99 numbers on them in squares. It had 99 squares. And he had a few of them. And he would have to go through, and he'd stare at that thing, and he would count 1 to 99, and he would, you know, make his eye hit number 1, and then his eye hit number 2, and then so on.
Really?
And
interesting.
His eyeball would, like, dart around until he got 1 to 99. And it would hit, and he actually described it to me once. He held his arms in a really big circle, and he said, I said, what does that do for you? And he held his arms in this really big circle, and then he took it, and he moved the circle until it was small, and then he took his fingers and made the OK sign, and then he took that OK sign and he squeezed it down until it was like the size of a straw, and he said, it takes my concentration from here to there, but, you know, with the movement of his arms right down to his fingers. So it pinpoints his concentration. Like I once heard, like Lou Holtz, the football coach at Notre Dame, used to do multiplication tables before a football game. Anything to sharpen your focus, because it is so mental. So everybody has different preparations. Tom Glavine was going to the Hall of Fame. He would have a conversation with you the day he pitched because it would relax him. He didn't want to do an interview, but he would say hello. Curt Schilling would rip your head off if you say hello to him. Tom Glavine was more than happy to say hello to him. The day he pitched. Cliff Lee is, one thing we get into the book is he kind of has this whatever personality.
I hate the whatever, yeah.
Yeah, the whatever. So he would actually, the day he pitches, he's kind of footloose and fancy free. He'll walk by you in his flip-flops and, you know, he'll do his work, his preparation. He'll do his study the hitters, but he's more, that's just the way he deals with things. And so everybody's a little bit different, but there's no question opening day is why they're in this game. It's to begin the new season, and there is definitely a level of excitement that comes with opening day. Yep.
Now, what happens to the pitchers on the days they're not pitching? What are they? Are they still preparing in some way? Are they still studying the other players? I mean, what do they do between starts?
Oh, well, that's a great question. I think there's probably a belief that they go on vacation. That's the ones that go on vacation or take the following 4 days off are the ones that don't last very long in the game. They're constantly working on their craft. You know, the day after they pitch is usually a recovery day. They actually might pick up a ball, play some light catch in case of, you know, just some lingering soreness or whatever, kind of flush it out of there. They play catch almost every day. It's how you build arm strength and maintain arm strength. And then on a middle day, usually 2 days before they get back on the mound, they'll throw what's commonly called a bullpen. They'll go to the bullpen with the pitching coach and a catcher, and you know something might not have went well in the previous start. Maybe his breaking ball wasn't particularly sharp. Maybe he had trouble getting the ball in on right-handers. And they'll go down and they'll work on something. He'll go through his whole pitch repertoire and he'll work on those little things, maybe making a mechanical adjustment, maybe work on a particular part of the strike zone. And, you know, the day before they usually shift into the preparation, we start game planning and whatnot. You know, there's a lot of cardiovascular conditioning that goes into being a pitcher because, you know, you're out there, you know, gosh, you throw, you know, 65 warm-up pitches or more, and you throw 120 in the game, you do warm-ups between innings. You know, sometimes you're up around 170 pitches before you, you know, before your day is over or maybe even more. There's long toss, so you know you have to be in really, really good condition. You might be standing out there for two hours and 10 minutes on a hot day.
Do you think
cardio as well?
Do you think it's gotten a lot more harder on pitchers? Do you think back in the '70s and eighties they were as driven as they are now? It seems like there's so much more into pitching nowadays than there used to be. I mean, or is that just does it seem that way?
I think the game. I don't think it's ever changed. The game is always, pitching has always kind of ruled the game. Even in years when, you know, offense takes over, good pitching can neutralize offense. So pitching, the importance of pitching, I think, has always been paramount. You know, there might have been more of a toll on pitchers, you know, a generation ago or more because, you know, now they use a five-man rotation. Now, teams are more, and pitchers themselves are more protective of their arms because, I mean, let's face it, the pitching arm is one of the most fragile pieces of hardware in sports.
Right.
And you have to protect it. And there's great arguments over, you know, pitch counts and whatnot. And, you know, the old schoolers say you got to throw a lot. The new schoolers are more protective. But the importance of it, all of that kind of just shows the importance of it. It's always, to me, reigns supreme in the game.
I like the fact that, I mean, right in the middle of the book, that you talk about Halladay and how he's getting ready for the game, and I love the way that he stopped and signed that little kid's ball. I mean, that just, when I read that little passage, and I thought, wow, Halladay's a human being, too. He really cares about his fans. And that makes me feel good inside to know that these pitchers, who have so little time to begin with, would stop and sign a ball. It would stop and say hello to a fan, you know?
Was that the morning in Wrigley Field?
It might have been. I can't remember which.
Yeah, it was the morning. It was in July, and that was two nights earlier. He had suffered heat exhaustion on the mound, if you remember.
Ah, yes.
He had a little virus or something, and he had to leave that game. He just overheated. And, you know, I talked about bullpen sessions. Well, two mornings later, before a day game, he's having his, what they call his between starts bullpen session. He's out there working on things. And there was a tour going through the ballpark. And I was sitting in the press box and I saw it with my own eyes. And this little kid breaks away from the tour and probably got scolded. But he breaks away from the tour as Roy is finishing and walking toward the dugout. And it is 97 degrees, and I'm sure Roy is just absolutely dripping sweat. And
right.
Can only think about getting into the air-conditioned clubhouse. And this kid, the ballpark is empty except for some workers on this tour. The kid shouts to him, and Roy waits for him, signs his ball, and the kid leaves with this, I'm sure, lifelong memory. And I just was very kind of touched by the moment. You know, and I'm sure, you know, Roy, he is a good person. He's got two young sons who are probably about that kid's age, so I'm sure he knew what the kid was all about. It meant something to him. But those are the little details that, you know, you're not really sure what to do with something like that. As you're covering a team, it doesn't fit in a game story. It might not fit anywhere. You're not working on a story about Roy Halladay that day, but you kind of file them. Those are the little details you kind of file away and hopefully can bring your narrative alive when you get around to writing the book.
And that's why the book is so much fun. There's these little things in there that you can read that you didn't know during the season that make you feel good, that make you feel like they're, you know they're all driven, you know, they're all very concentrated and they have to stay that way. And they get paid a lot of money to do this job. It's not like they're going in there and not a lot is expected of them. A lot is it. I love the stories about Jimmy Rollins and what music he likes to listen to and what he's got is on his iPod, and you know, I love those little stories. You know, and Jimmy strutting around in his bathrobe. it makes you laugh, and yet, you know, you wonder what affects the play of the game. You know, do these little things help them play better? You know, or what little things can affect the outcome of a game? Can stuff that happens before the game affect? Can their mood affect the game? I mean, there's so many factors involved.
I think your mood can affect anything you do. I mean, there's days, you know, I think in everybody's job, you know, it's just not happening. And that probably goes back to the frame of mind you're in. So I actually think mood plays a lot about how they do things. And maybe that starts with, you know, if you have three good games in a row, you're in a good frame of mind. Maybe it's the chicken and the egg, the production or the performance on the field affects the state of mind, and that can carry you for a few more games. But, you know, they all have their routines, and, you know, I do think the stuff that happens before a game can affect them, because that comes down to preparation, and preparation is so important. Everybody has their little quirks, you know. Chase Utley is always the first guy out to stretch, always. You know, it would be shocking if he wasn't one day, but I think he's kind of the personification. If he was a basketball player, you'd call him a gym rat. You know, he's always there early, working on things, and that's him. Jimmy is looser before games. He'll throw his bathrobe on, make people laugh, and he kind of, you know, he'll pick some of the music, or Jason Worth used to pick the music, or, you know, and it's funny because some guys love rap, some guys love country, some guys are heavy metal, it's a group of, you know, 25 guys, all different interests, but at 7 o'clock, their interests better all be the same thing.
Exactly. So, I mean, as a fan, you know, you watch the games, you enjoy them, you want them to win. I mean, who doesn't want the Phillies to win? I mean, it's kind of a letdown when they don't. But still, like you said, it's part of the game. There's going to be wins, there's going to be losses. That's just the way it is. And you think of Roy Halladay, you think, how could Roy Halladay ever lose a game? He's so great at what he does. I mean, he's got all those books with preparation. He knows the players. He knows how to pitch to them, you know, but you forget that they're human beings, too, and they could easily make a mistake. I mean, I was watching Roy Halladay on the other day against Baltimore in the preseason game, and, you know, he didn't look his sharpest, and we forget that's part of the game, too, that they're not going to be perfect all the time.
No, and that goes back to what I said earlier. I think people forget how hard this game is. It's a really hard game. And you know what? They're not Superman, and that's one of the things that we tried to do in that chapter. I think it was the July chapter about Roy Halladay. Show his human side, and you can kind of extend that to all the guys. There is a human element. We talk about Roy Oswalt in the book and how he was struggling with you know, the human emotion of I guess you'd call it emotion of feeling like you're letting people down because his back hurts, not wanting to admit it. So you know, all of those things show you the human side of these people. And, you know, the clubhouse after they lost on October 7th, I think it was, how like a funeral parlor it was. And those are all human emotion that come out, and you can't forget that. You know, despite their extraordinary talent and their huge paychecks, they are people.
I wonder what happens when they get home after that, after the loss, and how deeply. I mean, you know, they feel it deeply, but I mean, how it affects them. Do they get angry? Do they, you know, or what exactly happens? I mean, it's fascinating to watch the aftermath like that. I mean, we don't get to see that. We only get to see what happens on the field. And they're such good sports. I mean, that's another thing. When I watch the games, after the game, you realize these players, they've been taught. You know, they've got to act like professionals. They're not. It's not some little league game where you can show your emotion on the field. You got to rein it in. I mean, sometimes it gets away.
Some guys show it. They're smart enough to smash a bat down in the dugout tunnel or smash a helmet where nobody can see them because it doesn't reflect well on them. But I will tell you, there are some temper tantrums, and as they call them, some snaps. They call them snaps. And guys will snap, but they'll do it away from the public eye. But, you know, I remember covering the Yankees and looking at a bathroom behind a dugout that some player tore up one night after having a bad night. I've heard of players... I heard of a player once being told by an equipment manager, I'm out of helmets. Please don't smash any more helmets so I get a new shipment in.
Oh, that's
so
funny.
It does happen.
But it's expected. That stuff's got to happen. I mean, you can't keep it in forever.
Because they care, you know? I mean, you know, when I write a shitty story, I feel like smashing my computer. So it happens. It happens. As far as taking it home, I think, you know, like you said, we're not there. Almost every athlete I've ever talked to says, I never take it home. Boy, they're really good if they never take it home, because I do take my bad days home. Hopefully I don't take it out on people, but I stew in them.
Right. It's very hard not to. Yeah.
I would be willing to bet they stew in their bad days, too.
Right.
But they're smart enough to learn that. They need to pick themselves up really quick, because tomorrow's game is just important. And if you have another bad one and another bad one, you know, you're going to be, you know, the game's going to weed you out. So, you know, closers are probably the best example. When they blow a save, you know, close, that's a tough job because, you know, you come trotting in the eighth inning with a one run, or in the ninth inning with a one run lead, and, you know, you're supposed to get those final three outs, shake hands, and go home. It's supposed to be routine. It's supposed to be your job. Well, some nights it doesn't happen. And when it happens, you lose the game, you know. You go from, you know, ho-hum, I'm trying to finish off someone else's win here, to I just blew the game. And, you know, closers, they have to have a short memory and get over it really quick, because, you know, 24 hours later, the manager could be waving you in again. And if you're still stewing in the juices from a bad night the night before, it might affect you, and you might end up losing another one.
It's interesting when you read this book. I can't tell what passages you wrote and what passages Todd wrote, which is really nice. It's a seamless read. I mean, you can't pick one out and say, well, I know Todd wrote that, or I wrote Jim. So was it a group? Was it an effort on both of your parts to do this, or did you write some of it? Did he write some of it? How did that work?
Well, it was a complete team effort. We would sit down and you know, after a month, and we wanted to have a theme for every month. Halliday was a theme of 1 month. Roy Oswalt's kind of his pain with his back against Cliff Lee's dominance was the theme of July, kind of the two ends of the spectrum. And anticipation of October was sort of the September theme. And, so we'd talk about the theme, and somebody would sit down and start writing it. You'd write it, and we'd look at it, and we'd tweak, and we'd say, let's develop this more, let's take this out, let's leave this in, I like this, I don't like that, and then we'd revise it, and from there it would be done. But, you know, it really wasn't independent. We were talking to each other constantly, you know, hey, I think this would be a good way to go in this chapter. Yeah, let's go that way, that little incident that happened Tuesday night would be great there. Yeah, definitely. I'm going to use this quote here. Okay, no problem, yeah. And then, you know, we'd read it over constantly. And, you know, there were times on the road. I remember one day we were sitting out back at a hotel in California, and we were sort of just swapping laptops, you know, back and forth. So,
Was there anything major that didn't get in the book that you wanted to put in the book?
No, really not. No, everything, I mean, I guess maybe selfishly, the only thing I left out was the World Series parade. we covered everything we wanted to. At one point, we were fearful that maybe, maybe we were too long in some areas. Maybe we trimmed back a little bit here and there, but... No, we got everything we wanted to, because I think we both know who we are as writers, and reporting is our strength, and we always tried to make the extra phone call. You know, sometimes it took 2 or 3 months to get the interview we were looking for, you know.
Right.
I remember calling a particular general manager because I just wanted to ask him one question, and it took about 6 weeks for him to return my phone call.
Wow!
But he's busy running his own team, and that's understandable. But we had the luxury of waiting those 6 weeks, and you know, he answered that one question, and that one question is answered in the book. But I think that one question added to the book, so it was worth going that extra tomorrow.
Now, I have to ask you about Chase Utley. Currently, he's having all kinds of knee problems. What's your view as far as whether he'll come back full strength at some point?
Well, I don't know that he'll ever be full strength or ever be the same player he was in his prime, but I do think he will fight his way back onto the field. We're going to see how productive he is, how healthy he is.
He is a fighter, that's for sure.
And yeah, he's very passionate about the game. He loves the game. And sure, it's tearing his heart out that he can't be on the field because I think it's the thing he loves to do most in life. But, you know, you have to kind of piece together information about what's happening because they're not that open. But, you know, it sounds like he's got a very serious cartilage problem. When the general manager says you can't regrow cartilage, that makes me think there's some type of a cartilage deficit or
right.
major cartilage problem. And, you know,
I'm definitely worried about the Phillies' chances this season. I don't know. I mean, it's going to be an interesting season for sure. So, I mean, are we as hyped as we were last year? Absolutely not. But, you know, because there's been some changes and, you know, we've lost some players.
It's funny because last year there was so much hype.
Right.
And so much expectation. You know, Sports Illustrated was, they were in the clubhouse like every day in spring training.
Hmm.
Gary Smith was there, who's like one of the best writers in the world.
Right.
He was there writing about the Phillies almost every day. And this year, you know, they've been kind of under the radar, and they've had two big injuries with Utley and Howard. They don't have Oswalt, but they have an improving Vance Worley and Joe Blanton's healthy, and they still got Hamels and Halliday and Lee. I still think they've added a good closer, Jonathan Papelbon. I still think they're a pitching-based team. They better not get hurt in the pitching rotation. That's going to really hurt their chances because offense is not their strong suit. But if they pitch and stay healthy in the rotation and the bullpen, I still think they're going to be a pretty good team with a chance to contend and a chance to get to the postseason. And more and more and more, that's what's becoming about baseball is
what I'm worried about is the hitting in the postseason. That seems to always be when we can't do it. That seems to be one of the big problems. What's your take on that? Watching the team like you did, as far as the hitting, why does that hitting suddenly stop? What's causing?
Because they're not as good of a hitting team as they were in 2008, 2009, when they were leading the league in home runs, leading the league in runs. They slipped to seventh in the league in runs last year. So,
wow.
And hitting can come and go. It's a lot of it's predicated on the other guy on the mound. And, you know, they ran into Chris Carpenter, who, as good as Roy Halladay was in that last game of the season last year, Chris Carpenter was just a little bit better. And that's what happened there. But the Phillies, I still maintain they should have put away that series early.
Oh, absolutely.
I think a four-run lead to go in game two was crushing. But, you know, as far as this year, I still think they can compete and contend, and then, you know, it's about getting into October and getting hot. The Florida Marlins showed us that, you know, in 2003. St. Louis Cardinals showed us that in 2006 and again in 2011.
Wow, did they ever.
San Francisco Giants. It's about getting hot at the right time. Get there and get hot. And that's what this team's challenge is going to be.
And you looked at Atlanta toward the end of the season. I mean, Atlanta just kind of fell apart completely at the end of the season. You know, that's the beauty of baseball. You never know what's going to happen next. I mean, you can pitch an eight-inning masterpiece and throw it all away in the ninth inning. There's that little thing. If you don't fully do everything, the whole game could be ruined.
No question. The Braves were the antithesis to the thinking, you know, get hot late. They had a great season with all the great young guys in the bullpen and they were a team that really struggled on offense, and, you know, they just evaporated in front of our eyes. And the St. Louis Cardinals got hot from August 25th on and overtook them. And, you know, I'm interested to see the Braves this year if they grow, because I think failure can be a great teacher. And we'll see if they grow from that September failure, and it helps them this year.
There's another thing in the book that I really like, these little stories that are they're always in gray. Surrounded by the stripes. This one is on the road again with an UGH instead of AG. I love these little stories. I mean, how did they come about? They're really cool. And whose idea were they?
They were both of our ideas. We, I read a book, we both read it, by a couple friends of ours out of New York, Bob Clappish and John Harper. wrote a book about the 80, I don't want to get the year wrong, it was like the 89 Mets or the 90 Mets. It's called The Worst Team Money Could Buy. It was a team with great expectations that flopped.
Mm-hmm.
So they turned it into this, the worst team money could buy. And they had these little sidebars in the book where little interesting tidbitty things, kind of off the beaten path. And we both liked how they kind of broke up the copy and broke up, you know, gave your eye a rest. And it was a good way to set off something kind of cutesy. And I know the one you're talking about, that's the one where, you know, they're ragging Victorino about having to make a 2.5-hour trip to Fort Myers and
right.
And Wilson Valdez. And, you know, the idea is to become a veteran and not have to make those long trips. And Wilson Valdez got on the bus by accident. He wasn't supposed to make the trip, and everybody had a pretty good laugh about that. But I think that's the one where Charlie Manuel said he had to have his iPod charged up because he didn't want to listen to Victorino's yapping the whole way down.
Right. The Dominic Brown story is amazing. The one where he thought he was sent down to the minors and wasn't. That just blows your mind. When I read that, I thought, is this really true?
That was true. And you know what? It's funny. That came out of a conversation with a club official about 3 months after the fact. Too late to incorporate it into your daily coverage. It was just kind of an off-the-cuff thing, and then you ask a couple questions, and then, they acquired Hunter Pence on July 29th, and, you know, the natural speculation was Dominic would be returned to the minors, but they were going to keep him around for 2 days until they went on the road and then send him back. They're going to use him as a pinch hitter, but Dominic, you know, all the speculation is raging, and Dominic read it on TV that he'd been sent down. He read it on the crawl on the MLB Network. He took it upon himself to go to the stadium and pack his stuff and drive off to Lehigh Valley, where the AAA team is. And he arrives there the next day, and they get a call. Phillies get a call. Dominic's here. You know, what do you want us to do? And the general manager, Ruben Amaro, is like, what do you mean Dominic's there? We didn't send him out. So they put Dominic on the phone, and Dominic says, yeah, I read it on the MLB Network. And Ruben Amaro said, we didn't send you down, but, you know, I'm not going to make you drive all the way back. So they faxed him the paperwork, and they got the transaction done.
It's just staggering to hear that. You know, like, how can it be? It's almost comical if it weren't serious.
I think it's very comical, yeah. But, you know, a reporter jumped the gun, you know, and took, you know, we all knew it was coming, but, you know, you can't assume it's coming when you think it's coming. You got to hear it that he's been optioned to AAA. And the MLB Network jumped the gun and said that Dominic Brown has been optioned to AAA. And Dominic Brown believed it. If you're going to believe it anywhere, you believe it on the MLB Network, right?
Yeah, you would think.
The teams own the network. So he took off and went to AAA. Showed that he was intent on getting right back to work and wasn't going to let it keep him down. But they didn't intend on sending him down. And when we were, you know, told the story 3 months after it happened, it was, like you said, it was very comical.
As a fan now, I mean, I live and breathe with these games sometimes, and I get very depressed when they lose, and I wonder as a writer how hard that is to distance yourself from that. I mean, you're a fan, it's also your job, so you have to do your job. It's like the announcers. I always wonder, you know, they have to be objective about the other team, too. And how hard is that for you when they lose and you are upset about them losing, but you still have to do your job? How difficult does it get for you?
It doesn't get difficult at all because I don't get upset when they lose. I'm not a fan. I'm a fan of the game. I love the game.
You're still a Phillies fan, though.
No, I'm not. I'm really not a Phillies fan. No, I you know, I'm a detached observer. You know, this is what I do for my job. I'm a fan of the game. I appreciate the game. I love the game. I love watching the game. But, you know, I don't take losses hard at all. You know, sometimes you have to be a little more. You have to tiptoe around the clubhouse a little more because people have had a bad day at work. But no, it doesn't affect me. It doesn't affect my moods. You know, they were knocked out in October on October 7th. And on October 8th, you know, I went out and raked leaves. It honestly didn't get me down at all, you know. As someone, you know, working on this book where, you know, a World Series championship would have been the ultimate final chapter. And, hey, you know, part of you is rooting for the story, sure. You always root for the story when you're a writer, but as far as my personal life, it doesn't affect it at all, you know. My kids are disappointed. They're big Phillies fans, but, you know, they were out raking leaves with me on October 8th, too, so they didn't take it very hard. you just learn. In some ways, and I don't mean to sound... in some ways, this job kills the fan in you, you know. You know, it takes you away from your home a lot, you know. You stand in a clubhouse for an hour waiting for a guy who may or may not come out from the training room or the back room so you can get one question that you want to ask him. You see, especially in my newspaper days, you know, we'd see a thrilling bottom of the ninth inning rally, and as thrilling as it was, it's agony for the writer because I already have 500 words written about, you know, them losing. And now I got to turn this thing around in the next 3 minutes and get this story in about this harrowing, hellacious ninth inning collapse. And, you know, those things can be tough, but...
what you do is difficult, yeah. I mean, you've got to be creative all the time.
So, you know, I'm not a fan of the team per se. There's people I like and respect, and yeah, I'd like to see them do well, but, you know, you still got to just cover the team. That's what you do.
Where were you born?
I was born in Providence, Rhode Island.
Providence, Rhode Island. So you're more of a Red Sox area fan.
I grew up that way, but I've been in Philadelphia for almost 20 years, and if they'll have me, I consider myself a Philadelphian now.
But yet when you see Ryan Howard laying on the field at the end of the season in pain, it still affects you, just like it would affect any other fan, I would think. You know,
Absolutely. It affected me the night Doc Holliday's eyes rolled into the back of his head in Wrigley Field. I mean, just, you know, we all have hearts beating in our chests.
Right.
You hate to see, you know, it affected me when I saw Norm Charlton get hit in the forehead by a line drive on the mound and break his skull. It affected me. Mm. Ryan Howard blowing out his Achilles. I happen to like Ryan Howard very much, and I respect him very much. And, you know, he played through a year's worth of ankle problems. And, you know, you wonder if that was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back, all that,
yes,
that kind of maybe wear and tear on his ankle. So,
not to mention the fact that he struck out a lot too. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, is that a result of what he's going through? I mean, who knows? There's so much involved.
Yeah. So you absolutely feel for a guy, but you gotta do your job. You gotta go find out what happened. How severe is it? What are they gonna do to treat it? What's the rehab gonna be like? And you gotta do that. So, but
well, I hope we see more.
I think you can.
Right. We just about run out of time. I know you have to go. It's been really great to talk to you. I'm looking forward to you writing another book. I can't wait to read the next one. Hopefully another book about the Phillies. I'd love to see another one. The book, again, is called The Rotation. It's by Jim Salisbury and Todd Zielecki. Tell Todd I'm sorry. I forgot his name in the beginning there. But it's such a terrific book, and the fans will just love it. Thank you so much, Jim. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, thank you, David. I had a great time doing it, and thanks for all your kind words.
Right. And this has been David's Book Talk. We'll talk to you next time.